was broader than the side of a horse, towering up into an immensity of spreading branches. Its boughs were laden with pale silver-green leaves and small golden fruits with a horrible stink. And beneath the bark, looking at us, was a human face, overgrown and smoothed out into mere suggestion, with two hands crossed across the breast like a corpse. Two great roots forked at its feet, and in the hollow between them lay a skeleton, almost swallowed by moss and rotting leaves. A smaller root twisted out through one open eye socket, and grass poked through ribs and scraps of rusted mail. The remains of a shield lay across the body, barely marked with a black double-headed eagle, the royal crest of Rossia. We pulled up our snorting, heaving horses just short of its branches. Behind me, I heard a sudden snapping noise, like the door of an oven slamming shut, and at the same moment I was struck by a heavy weight out of nowhere, thrown out of my saddle. I hit the bare ground painfully, the air knocked out of my lungs, my elbow scraped, and legs bruised. I twisted. Kasha was on top of me. She'd knocked me off my horse. I stared up past her. My horse was in the air above us, headless. A monstrous thing, like a praying mantis, was holding it up in two forelegs. The mantis blended against the heart tree, narrow golden eyes, the same shape as the fruits, and the body of the same silvery green as the leaves. It had bitten the horse's head off, with a single snap, in the same lunging movement. Behind us, another of the soldiers had fallen headless, and a third was screaming, his leg gone, thrashing in the grip of another mantis. There were a dozen of the creatures coming out of the trees. Chapter 15. The silver mantis dropped my horse to the ground and spat out the head. Kasha was scrambling up, dragging me away. We were all caught in horror for a moment, and then Prince Marek shouted wordlessly and flung his horn at the head of the silver mantis. He dragged out his sword. "Fall in! Get the wizards behind us!" he roared, and spurred his horse onward, getting between us and the thing, slashing at it. His sword skidded down the carapace, peeling it a long translucent strip, as though he'd been paring a carrot. The war horses showed they really were worth their weight in silver. They weren't panicking now, as any ordinary beast would have done, but rearing and lashing out, their voices shrilling. Their hooves struck with hollow thumps against the mantis shells. The soldiers made a loose circle round me and Kasha, the dragon and falcon pulling their horses in on either side of us. All the soldiers were putting their reins in their teeth. Half of them had already drawn swords, making a bristling wall of points to protect us, while the others settled their shields on their arms first. The mantis creatures were coming out of the trees to surround us. They were still hard to see in the dappled light with the trees moving, but no longer invisible. They didn't move like the walkers, slow and stiff. They ran lightly forward on four legs, the white spiked jaws of their front legs quivering. "Sweet Alekin! Sweet Along!" the falcon was shouting, summoning that blazing white fire he'd used in the tower. He flung it out like a lash to curl around the forelegs of the nearest mantis as it reared up to snatch for another man. He jerked on the line like a man pulling in a resisting calf and dragged the mantis forward. There was a crackling, bitter smell of burning oil where the fire pressed against its shell, thin plumes of white smoke curling away. Off balance, the mantis snapped its terrible mandibles on thin air. The falcon pulled its head into the line, and one of the soldiers hacked at its neck. I didn't have much hope. In the valley, our ordinary axes and swords and scythes barely scraped the skin of the walkers. But this sword somehow bit deep. Chips of chitin flew into the air, And the man on the other side worked the point of his sword into the joint where the neck met the head. He put his weight against the hilt and shoved it through. The mantis's shell cracked loudly like a crab's leg, and its head sagged, the jaws going limp. Ichor oozed out of its body, over the sword blade, steaming, and I briefly saw letters gleam golden through the haze before they faded again into the steel. But even as the mantis died, its whole body lurched forward, pushing through the ring and nearly knocking into the falcon's horse. Another mantis leaned in through the open space, reaching for him, but he seized the reins in a fist and controlled his mount as it tried to rear, then pulled his lash of fire back and cracked it into the second mantis's face. On the ground with Kasha, I could barely see anything else of the fighting. I heard Prince Marek and Janos shouting encouragements to the soldiers, and the harsh, scraping noise of metal meeting shell. Everything was confusion and noise, happening so quickly, I almost couldn't breathe, much less think. I looked up wildly at the dragon, who was fighting his own alarmed horse. I saw him snarl something under his breath and kick his feet loose from the stirrups. He threw the reins to one of the soldiers, a man whose horse was sagging with a terrible gaping cut to its chest, and slid down to the ground beside us. "What should I do?" I cried to him. I groped helplessly for a spell. "Murgitor?" "No," he shouted at me over the cacophony, and seizing my arm turned me around facing the heart tree. "We're here for the queen. If we spend ourselves fighting a useless battle, all of this has been for nothing." We had stayed back from the tree, but the mantises were herding us towards it little by little, forcing us all beneath the boughs, and the smell of the fruit was burning in my nostrils. The trunk was hideously vast. I had never seen a tree so large, even in the deepest forest, and there was something grotesque about its size, like a swollen tick full of blood. This time, a threat alone wouldn't work, even if I could have summoned up the rage to call Fulmia. The wood wasn't going to hand over the queen to save even so large a heart tree, not now that it knew we could kill the tree afterwards, purging her. I couldn't imagine what we could do to this tree. The smooth bark shone with a hard luster like metal. The dragon was staring at it narrowly, muttering as he worked his hands. But even before the leaping current of flame splashed against the bark, I knew instinctively it would do no good, and I didn't believe even the soldier's enchanted swords could bite into that wood at all. The dragon kept trying. Spells of breaking, spells of opening, spells of cold and lightning, systematic even while the fighting raged around us. He was looking for some weakness, some crack in the armor. But the tree withstood everything, and the smell of the fruit grew stronger. Two more of the mantis creatures had been killed. Four more soldiers were dead. Kasha made a muffled cry as something rolled to a thump against my foot, and I looked down at Janus's head, his clear blue eyes still fixed in an intent frown. I jerked away from it in horror and tripped to my knees, sickened all at once, and helplessly I vomited on the grass. "Not now," the dragon shouted at me, as though I could help it. I had never seen fighting before, not like this, this slaughter of men. They were being killed like cattle. I sobbed on my hands and knees, tears falling in the dirt, and then I put out my hands and gripped the widest roots near me and said, "Kisara, Kisara, Vij," like a chant. The roots twitched. "Kisara," I said again, over and over, and droplets of water slowly collected on the surface of the roots, oozing out of them, and rolling down to join the tiny damp spots, one after another, after another. The dampness spread, became a circle between my hands. The thinnest branching rootlets in the open air were shriveling in on themselves.
Tullion Vige,
I said, whispering, coaxing.
Qui sera?
The roots began to writhe and squirm in the ground like fat earthworms as the water squeezed out of them, thin rivulets running. There was mud between my hands now, spreading and running away from the bigger roots, exposing more of them. The dragon knelt beside me. He took up the song of an enchantment that rang vaguely familiar in my ears, something I had heard once long before. The spring after the green year, I remembered, when he'd come to help the fields recover. He'd brought us water from the spindle then, with channels that dug themselves from the river all the way to our burned and barren fields. But this time, the narrow channels ran away from the hard tree instead, and as I chanted the water out of the roots, they carried the water far away, and the ground around the roots began to parch into desert, mud cracking into dust and sand. Then Kasha caught us both by the arms and nearly levered us up from the ground, pulling us stumbling forward. The walkers we'd passed in the trees were coming into the clearing now, a whole host of them, as though they'd been lying in wait for us. The silver mantis had lost a limb, but still pressed the attack, darting side to side and lashing out with spiked arms wherever an opening afforded. The horses Janos had worried about were nearly all down or fled by now. Prince Marek fought on foot, shoulder to shoulder with 16 men in a row, their shields overlapping into a wall, and the falcon still lashing fire from behind them. But we were being crowded in, ever closer to the trunk. The heart tree's leaves were rustling in the wind, louder and louder, a dreadful whispering, and we were nearly at the foot of the tree. I dragged in a breath and almost vomited again from the sweet, dreadful stink of the fruit. One of the walkers tried edging around the side of the line, craning his head around sideways to see us. Kasha snatched a sword from the ground, fallen from some soldier's hand, and swung it in a wild sideways arc. The blade struck the walker's side and splintered through it with a crack like a breaking twig. It fell into a twitching heap. The dragon was coughing beside me from the stench of the fruit, but we took up our chant again, desperately, and dragged more water from the roots. Here, close to the tree, the thicker roots resisted at first, but together our spells pulled the water from them, from the earth, and the dirt began to crumble in around the tree. Its branches were shivering. Water was beginning to come rolling down the trunk in thick green-stained droplets too. Leaves were beginning to dry up and shed like rain from above us. But then I heard a terrible scream. The silver mantis had seized another one of the men from out of the line. And this time it did not kill him. It bit off the hand that held the sword and flung him to the walkers. The walkers reached up and plucked fruits off the tree and crammed them into his mouth. He screamed around them, choking, but they pressed more upon him and forced his jaw shut around them, juice spilling in rivulets down his face. His whole body arched, thrashing in their grip. They held him upside down over the earth. The mantis jabbed him in the throat with one sharp point of its claw, and the blood came spurting out of him and watered the dry, parched roots like rain. The tree made a sighing, shivering sound as thin lines of red flushed down the roots and faded into the silver of its trunk. I was sobbing in horror, watching the life drain out of his face. A knife took him in the chest, sinking into his heart. Prince Marek had thrown it. But much of our work had already been undone, and the walkers were ringing us all around, waiting, hungrily, it now seemed. The men drew closer together, panting. The dragon cursed under his breath. He turned back to the tree and used another spell, one I had seen him use before to form his potion bottles. He cast it now, and reached down into the desiccated sand around our feet and began to pull out ropes and skeins of glowing glass. He flung them in swooping heaps onto the exposed roots, the falling leaves. Small fires began to catch around us, putting up a haze of smoke. I was shaking, dazed with horror and blood. Kasia pushed me behind her, the sword in her hand, sheltering me even while tears were sliding down her face too.
"Look out!"
she shouted, and I turned to see a great branch above the dragon's head crack. It came falling heavily onto his shoulder and knocked him forward. He caught himself instinctively on the trunk, dropping the rope of glass he was holding. He tried to pull away, but the tree was already seizing him, bark growing over his hands.
"No!"
I screamed, reaching for him. He managed to drag one arm free at the cost of the other. Silver bark climbing to the elbow. Roots whipping themselves out of the ground and twining about his leg, dragging him in closer. They were tearing at his clothes. He seized a pouch at his waist, jerked the strap loose, and thrust something into my hands. It gurgled, a vial glowing fierce red-violet. It was Fireheart, a dram of it, and he shook me by the arm.
"Now, you fool! If it takes me, you're all dead! Burn it and run!"
I looked up from the bottle and stared at him. He meant me to fire the tree, I realized. He meant me to burn the tree, and him with it.
"Do you think I'd rather live like this?"
he said to me, his voice tight and clenched, as though he was speaking past horror. The bark had already swallowed one of his legs and climbed nearly to the shoulder. Kasia was next to me, her face pale and stricken. She said,
"Nyashka, it's worse than dying. It's worse."
I stood with a vial clenched in my hand, glowing between my fingers, and then I put my hand on his shoulder and said to him,
"Ulogistus, the purging spell. Cast it with me."
He stared at me. Then he gave one short jerk of a nod.
"Give her the vial," he said between his clenched teeth.
I gave Kasia the fire heart and gripped the dragon's hand, and together we said the spell. I whispered,
"Ulogistus, Ulogistus,"
a steady drumbeat. And then they joined in with me, reciting all the long, careful song of it. But I didn't let the purging magic flow. I held it back. In my mind, I built a dam before the power of it, let our joint spell fill up a vast lake within me as the working built and built. The swelling heat of it filled me, burning bright, almost unbearable. I couldn't breathe. My lungs crushed against my ribcage, my heart strained to beat. I couldn't see. The fighting went on somewhere behind me, a distant clamoring only. Shouts, the eerie clatter of the walkers, the hollow ring of swords. It was coming closer and closer still. I felt Kasia's back pressed to mine. She was making herself a final shield. The fire heart was singing, cheerful and hungry, in the vial she held, hoping to be let out, hoping to devour us all, almost comforting. I held the working as long as I could, until the dragon's voice failed, and then I opened my eyes again. The bark had climbed over his neck, up his cheek. It had sealed over his mouth. It was creeping around his eye. He squeezed my hand once, and then I poured the power through him, down the half-formed channel, to the devouring tree. He stiffened, his eyes going wide and unseeing. His hand clenched on mine in silent agony. Then, the bark over his mouth withered away, flaking like the shed skin of some monstrous snake, and he was screaming aloud. I clutched his hand with both of mine, biting my lip against the pain of his brutal grip, while he cried out, the tree blackening and charring away around him, leaves above us crackling into flames.
They were falling, stinging bits of ash, the hideous smell of the fruit cooking and liquefying. Juice ran down the limbs, and sap came bursting in boiling hot gouts from the trunks and the bark. The roots caught as quickly as well-seasoned firewood, which pulled so much water out of them. The bark was loosening and peeling off in great strips. Kasha grabbed the dragon's arm and wrestled his limp body away from the tree, blistered and seared. I helped her pull him away through the gathering smoke, and then she turned and plunged through the haze again. Dimly, I saw her gripping a slab of bark, pulling it away in a thick sheet. She hacked at the tree with her sword and pried at it, and more of the sides broke away. I laid the dragon down and stumbled to help her. The tree was too hot to touch, but I put my hands over it anyway, and after a groping moment, I blurted, "Ilmeon! Come out! Come out!" As if I were Yaga calling a rabbit out of a burrow for dinner. Kasha hacked at it again, and then the wood split with a crack, and I saw through it a sliver of a woman's face, blank, a staring blue eye. Kasha reached into the edges of the broken gap and started pulling away more of the wood, breaking it away. And suddenly, the queen came falling out, her whole body bending limply forward out of a hollow of wood, and leaving a woman's shape behind, scraps of desiccated cloth falling away from her body and catching fire even as she tipped through the broken opening. She stopped, hanging. Her head wouldn't come free, held by a net of golden hair, impossibly long and embedded in the wood all around her. Kasha slashed the sword down through the cloud, and the queen came loose and fell into our arms. She was as heavy and inert as a log. Smoke and fire wreathed us, and above us the moaning and thrashing of the branches. The tree had become a pillar of fire. The fire heart was clamoring so loudly in its vial. It seemed to me I could hear it with my ears, eager to come out and join the blaze. We staggered forward, Kasha all but dragging the three of us, me, Queen Hannah, and the dragon. We fell out from beneath the branches into the clearing. The falcon and Prince Marek alone of the soldiers remained, fighting back to back with ferocious skill. Marek's sword lit with the same white fire the falcon held. The last four walkers crowded close. They made a sudden rush. The falcon whipped them back with a circling lash of fire, and Marek chose one and leapt for it, through the blaze. He caught its neck in one mailed fist and wrapped his boots about the body, one foot hooked underneath one of the forelimbs. He drove his sword down hard between the base of the neck and the body and twisted himself, almost exactly the motion of pulling a twig away from a leading branch, and the long narrow head of the walker splintered and cracked. He let its twitching body drop, then dived back through the dying ring of fire before the other walkers could close in on him. Four other dead walkers lay sprawled in the exact same way on the ground. He'd worked out a method, then, for killing them. But the walkers had almost caught him at the end, and he was staggering with fatigue. He had thrown aside his helm. He ducked his head and wiped his tabard across his dripping forehead, panting. The falcon was sagging beside him also. Though his lips never stopped moving, the silver fire around his hands was burning low. The white cloak had been discarded across the dirt, smoking, where burning leaves were falling upon it. The three walkers backed away, making ready for another rush. He drew himself up. "Nyeshka!" Kasha said, spurring me out of a dull staring, and I stumbled forward, opening my mouth. Only a ragged croak came out. Smoke hoarsened. I struggled for another breath and managed to whisper, "Full Madesh!"
or at least enough of a suggestion of the word to give my magic form, even as I fell forward and put my hands on the ground. The earth cracked along a line running away from me, opening beneath the walkers. As they fell into it thrashing, the falcon flung fire into the crevice, and it closed up around them. Marek turned, and then he suddenly came running towards me as I staggered up. He slid into the dirt, heels first, and kicked my legs back out from under me. The silver mantis had launched out of the burning cloud of the heart tree, its wings alight and crackling with fire, seeking some last vengeance. I stared up into its golden, inhumane eyes. Its dreadful claws drew back for another lunge. Marek was flat on the ground beneath its belly. He set his sword against the seam of the carapace and kicked its leg out from under it, one of only three remaining. It fell impaling itself. Even as he heaved up, it thrashed wildly, going over, and he pushed it off his sword with one final kick to join the raging blaze of the heart tree. It lay still. Marek turned and dragged me up to my feet. My legs were shaking, my whole body trembling. I couldn't hold myself upright. I had always been dubious of war stories, songs of battle. The occasional fights between boys in the village square had always ended in mud and bloody noses, and clawing, snot and tears. Nothing graceful or glorious. And I didn't see how adding swords and death to the mix could make it any better. But I couldn't have imagined the horror of this. The falcon was stumbling over to another man, lying curled in the dirt. He had a vial of some elixir in his belt. He fed the man a swallow of it and helped him up. Together, they went to a third, with one arm only left. He had cauterized the stump in the fire and lay dazed on the ground, staring up. Two men left, of 30. Prince Marek didn't seem stricken. He absently wiped an arm across his forehead again, smearing more soot across his face. He had already caught his breath, nearly. His chest rose and fell. But easily, not in a struggling heaves I could barely get, as he easily pulled me with him, away from the flames to the cooler shelter of the trees beyond the clearing's edge. He didn't speak to me. I don't know if he even knew me. His eyes were half glazed. Kasha joined us. The dragon heaved over her shoulders. She stood easily beneath his dead weight. Marek blinked a few more times, while the falcon gathered the two men towards us, and then he seemed to finally become aware of the spreading bonfire of the tree, the blackening branches falling. His grip on my arm tightened into bruising pain, the edges of the gauntlet digging into my flesh as I tried to pry at it. He turned to me and shook me, his eyes widening with rage and horror. "What have you done?" he snarled at me, harsh with smoke, and then he went suddenly very still. The queen was standing in front of us, unmoving, lit golden in the light of the blazing tree. She stood like a statue where Kasha had propped her onto her feet, and her arms dangled by her sides. Her cropped hair was as yellow as Marek's, thin and fine. It floated around her head like a cloud. He stared at her, his face open as the beak of a hungry bird. He let go of me and reached out a hand. "Don't touch her," the falcon said sharply, hoarse with smoke. "Get the chains." Marek halted. He didn't take his eyes off her. For a moment I thought he wouldn't listen. Then he turned and stumbled across the ruin of the battlefield to the corpse of his horse. The chains the falcon had put on Kasha while he'd examined her were bundled up in cloth on the back of his saddle. Marek dragged them down and brought them back to us. The falcon took the yoke from him with the cloth, and cautiously, as wary as if he'd been approaching a mad dog, went towards the queen. She didn't stir. Her eyes didn't blink. It was as though she didn't even see him. He hesitated even so, and then he spoke the protection spell over himself again, and he put the yoke over her neck in one swift movement and backed away. She still didn't move. He reached out again, still with the cloth, and clasped the manacles onto her wrists, one after another. Then he draped the cloth over her shoulders. There was a loud, terrible crack behind us. We all jumped like rabbits. The heart tree had split down its trunk, one whole massive half leaning away. It came down with a roaring crash, smashing through the 100-year oaks on the edge of the clearing. A cloud of orange sparks roared up out of the heart of the trunk. The second half suddenly burst entirely into flames, consumed and roaring, and the branches thrashed once more and were still. The queen's body came alive with one jerky clenched motion. The chains scraped and clanked as she moved within them, a whine of metal, and she staggered away from us, putting her hands up in front of her. The cloth slid off her shoulders. She didn't notice it. She was groping at her own face with her curling, two long nails, clawing at herself with a low, incoherent moan. Marek sprang forward and caught her by the manacled wrists. She convulsively flung him off her with unnatural strength. Then she stopped and fixed a stare on him. He staggered back and caught his balance, straightened. Blood-stained, smeared with soot and sweat, he still looked a warrior and a prince. The green crest was still visible on his chest, the crown above the hydra. She looked at it, and then at his face. She didn't speak, but her eyes didn't leave him. He drew one quick harsh breath and said, "Mother." Chapter 16. She didn't answer him. Marek stood with his hands clenched, waiting, his eyes fixed on her face. But she didn't answer. We stood silent and oppressed, still breathing the smoke of the heart tree, the burning corpses of men, and the woods creatures. Finally, the falcon gathered himself and limped forward. He raised his hands towards her face, hesitating a moment, but she didn't flinch from him. He put his hands on her cheeks and turned her towards him. He looked into her, his pupils widening and narrowing, changing shape. The color of his irises went from green to yellow to black. Hoarsely he said, "There is nothing. I can't find any corruption in her at all," and let his hands drop. But there was nothing else either. She didn't look at us, or if she did, that was even worse. Her wide staring eyes didn't see our faces. Marek stood still, panting, in heaving breaths, staring at her. "Mother," he said again. "Mother, it's Marek. I've come to take you home." Her face didn't change. The first horror had faded out of it. She was staring and empty now, hollowed out. "Once we are out of the wood," I said, but my voice died in my throat. I felt odd and sick. "Did you ever get out of the wood, if you'd been in it for 20 years? But Marek seized on the suggestion. "Which way?" he demanded, sliding his sword back into its sheath. I rubbed ash away with a sleeve over my face. I looked down at my blistered and cracked hands, stained with blood. The hole from a part. "Loy Talal," I whispered to my blood. "Take me home." I led them out of the wood as best I could. I didn't know what we'd do if we met another walker, much less in Adamantis. We were a far distance from that shining company that had ridden into the wood that morning. In my mind, I imagine us a gleaning party, creeping through the forest on our way home before nightfall, trying not to startle so much as a bird. I picked our way carefully, through the trees. We didn't have any hope of breaking a trail, so we had to keep to the deer tracks and the thinner brush. We crept out of the wood half an hour before nightfall. I stumbled out from under the trees, still following the glimmer of my spell. Home. Home. Over and over again in my head. Sing-song. The glowing line ran curving towards the west and south, towards Dvernik. My feet kept carrying me after it, across the barren strip of raised dirt and into a wall of tall grass that finally became thick enough to hold me. Above the top edge of the grass, when I slowly raised my head, forested slopes rose up like a wall in the distance, hazy brown with the setting sun thrown along them. The northern mountains. We'd come out not far from the mountain pass from Rossiya. That made a certain sense. If the queen and Prince Vasily had been fleeing towards Rossiya and had been caught and taken into the wood from there. But it meant we were miles and miles away from Zatoček. Prince Marek came out of the wood behind me, with his head bent, his shoulders stooped, as if he were dragging a heavy weight behind him. The two soldiers followed him raggedly. They'd pulled off their mail shirts and abandoned them somewhere along the way inside the wood. Their sword belts, too. He alone was still in armor, and his sword was still in his hand. But when he reached the grass, he sank in on himself, to his knees, and stayed there without moving. The soldiers came up to him and fell to either side of him, flat on their faces, as though they'd only been pulled along in his wake. Kasha laid the dragon down on the ground next to me, trampling the grass flat with her feet to make room. He was limp and still, his eyes closed. His right side was scorched and blistered everywhere, red and deadly glistening, his clothes torn away and burned off his skin. I'd never seen burn so dreadful. The falcon sagged to the ground on his other side. He held one end of the chain that reached to the yoke on the queen's neck. He tugged on it, and she halted too, standing still and alone in the raised barren strip around the wood. Her face had the same inhuman stillness as Kasha's, only worse, because no one was looking out of her eyes. It was like being followed by a marionette. When we tugged the chain forward, she walked with a stiff, swinging puppet stride, as if she didn't entirely know how to use her arms and legs anymore, as if they wouldn't bend properly. Kasha said, "We have to get farther from the wood." None of us answered her, or moved. It seemed to me she was speaking from very far away. She carefully gripped me by the shoulder and shook me. "Nyeshka," she said. I didn't answer. The sky was deepening to twilight, and the early spring mosquitoes were busy around us, whining in my ear. I couldn't even lift my hand to slap away a big one, sitting right on my arm. She straightened up and looked at us all, irresolute. I don't think she wanted to leave us there alone, in the condition we were in, but there wasn't much choice. Kasha bit her lip, then knelt in front of me and looked me in the face. "I am going to Kamik," she said. "I think it's closer than Zatoček. I'll run all the way. Hold on, Nyeshka. I'll be back as soon as I can find anyone." I only stared at her. She hesitated, and then she reached into my skirt pocket and brought out Yaga's book. She pressed it into my hands. I closed my fingers around it, but I didn't move. She turned and plunged into the grass, hacking and pushing her way through, following the last light to the west. I sat in the grass, like a field mouse, thinking of nothing. The sound of Kasia fighting her way through the tall grass faded away. I was tracing the stitches of Yaga's book, feeling the soft ridges in the leather, mindlessly staring at it. The dragon lay inert beside me. His burns were getting worse, blisters rising translucent all over his skin. Slowly, I opened the book and turned pages. Good for burns, better with morning cobwebs and a little milk, said the laconic page for one of her simpler remedies. I didn't have cobwebs or milk, but after a little sluggish thought, I put out my hand to one of the broken stems of grass around us and squeezed a few milky green drops out onto my finger. I rubbed them between my thumb and finger and hummed, Iruch, Iruch, up and down, like singing a child down to sleep, and began to lightly touch the worst of his blisters, one after another, with my fingertip. Each one twitched and slowly began to shrink, instead of swell, the angriest red fading. The working made me feel, not better exactly, but cleaner, as though I were rinsing water over a wound. I kept singing on and on, and on and on. Stop making that noise, the falcon said finally, lifting his head on a hiss. I reached out and grabbed his wrist. Groshno's spell for burns, I told him. It was one of the charms the dragon had tried to teach me when he'd still been insisting on thinking me a healer. The falcon was silent, and then he hoarsely began. O Yudech Viruch! The start of the chant, and I went back to my humming. Iruch, Iruch. While I felt out his spell, fragile as a spoked wheel built out of stalks of hay instead of wood, and hooked my magic onto it. He broke off his chant. I managed to hold the working together long enough to prod him into starting again. It wasn't nearly the same as casting with the dragon. This was like trying to push in harness with an old and contrary mule that I didn't like very much, with savage hard teeth waiting to bite me. I was trying to hold back from the falcon, even while I drove on the spell. But once he picked up the thread, the working began to grow. The dragon's burns began fading quickly to new skin, except for a dreadful shiny scar twisting down the middle of his arm and side, where the worst of the blisters had been. The falcon's voice was strengthening beside me, and my head cleared too. Power was coursing through us, a renewed tide swelling, and he shook his head, blinking with it. He twisted his hand and caught my wrist, reaching for me, for more of my magic. Instinctively, I jerked loose, and we lost the thread of the working. But the dragon was already rolling over onto his hands, heaving for breath, retching. He coughed up masses of black wet soot out of his lungs. When the fit subsided, he sank back wearily onto his heels, wiping his mouth, and looked up. The queen was still standing on the raised ground nearby, a luminous pillar in the dark. He pressed the heels of his hands to his eyes.
Of all the fool's errands that ever were, he rasped,
so hoarse I could barely hear it, and dropped his hands again. He reached for my arm, and I helped him drag himself to his feet. We were alone in the sea of cooling grass.
We need to get back to Zatochik, he said, prodding, to the supplies we left there.
I stared back at him dully, my strength fading again as the magic ebbed. The falcon had already subsided back into a heap. The soldiers were beginning to shiver and twitch, their eyes staring as if they saw other things. Even Marek had gone inert, a silent slouch boulder between them. Kasia went for help, I said finally. He looked around at the prince, the soldiers, the queen, back to me and the falcon, down to the dregs of ourselves. He rubbed his face.
All right, he said. Help me lay them straight on their backs. The moon is almost up.
We wrestled Prince Marek and the soldiers, flat in the grass, all three of them, staring blindly at the sky. By the time we had wearily pushed down the grass around them, the moon was on their faces. The dragon put me between him and the falcon. We didn't have the strength for a full purging. The dragon and the falcon only chanted another few rounds of the shielding spell he'd used that morning, and I hummed my little cleansing spell. Puhas, puhas, kai, puhas. A little color seemed to come back into their faces. Kasha came back not quite an hour later, driving a woodcutter's cart with a hard expression.
I'm sorry I took so long, she said shortly.
I didn't ask how she'd got the cart. I knew what someone would have thought seeing her come from the direction of the wood looking as she did. We tried to help her, but she had to do the work mostly alone. She lifted Prince Marek and the two soldiers onto the cart, then heaved the three of us up after them. We sat with our legs dangling out the back. Kasha went to the queen and stepped between her and the trees, breaking the line of her gaze. The queen looked at her with the same blankness.
You aren't in there anymore, Kasha said to the queen. You're free. We are free.
The queen didn't answer her either. We were a week in Zatochek, all of us laid out on pallets in the barn on the edge of town. I don't remember any of it from the moment I fell asleep in the cart until I woke up 3 days later in the warm, quieting smell of hay, with Kasha at my bedside, wiping my face with a damp cloth. The dreadful honey-sweet taste of the dragon's purging elixir coated my mouth. When I was strong enough to stagger up from my cot later that morning, he put me through another round of purging and then made me do another for him.
The queen?
I asked him, as we sat on the bench outside afterwards, both of us rag-limp. He jerked his chin forward, and I saw her. She was in the shade on the other side of the clearing, sitting quietly on a stump beneath a willow tree. She still wore the enchanted yoke, but someone had given her a white dress. There wasn't a stain or smudge anywhere on it. Even the hem was clean, as if she hadn't moved from the spot since she'd been put into it. Her beautiful face was blank as an unwritten book.
Well, she's free, the dragon said. Was it worth the lives of 30 men?
He spoke savagely, and I hugged my arms around myself. I didn't want to think about that nightmarish battle, about the slaughter.
Those two soldiers? I said, a whisper.
They'll live, he said. And so will our fine princeling. More fortune than he deserves. The wood's grip on them was weak. He pushed himself up. Come, I'm purging them by stages. It's time for another round.
2 days later, Prince Marek was himself again, with a speed that made me feel dull and sorely envious. He rose from his bed in the morning, and by dinner time, he was wolfing down an entire roast chicken and doing exercises. I could barely taste the few mouthfuls of bread I forced down. Watching him pull himself up and down on a tree branch made me feel even more like a cloth that had been washed and wrung out too many times. Tomasz and Oleg were awake too, the two soldiers. I'd learned their names by then, ashamed that I didn't know any of the ones we'd left behind. Marek tried to take some food to the queen. She only stared at the plate he held out to her and wouldn't chew when he put slivers of meat in her mouth. Then he tried a bowl of porridge. She didn't refuse, but she didn't help. He had to work the spoon into her mouth, like a mother with an infant, just learning how to eat. He kept at it grimly. But after an hour, when he'd barely managed to get half a dozen swallows into her, he got up and hurled the bowl and spoon savagely against a rock, porridge and pottery shards flying. He stormed away. The queen
didn't even blink at that either. I stood in the doorway of the barn, watching and wretched. I couldn't be sorry to have got her out. At least she wasn't being tormented by the wood anymore, devoured to the scraps of herself. But this awful half-life left to her seemed worse than dying. She wasn't ill or delirious, the way Kasia had been those first few days after the purging. There just didn't seem to be enough left of her to feel or think. The next morning, Marek came up behind me and caught me by the arm as I trudged back to the barn with a bucket of well water. I jumped in alarm and slushed water over us both, trying to jerk out of his grip. He ignored both the water and my efforts and snapped at me. "Enough of this! They're soldiers, they'll be fine." "They'd already be fine if the dragon didn't keep emptying potions into their bellies. Why haven't you done anything for her?" "What do you imagine there is to do?" the dragon said, coming out of the barn. Marek wheeled on him. "She needs healing. You haven't even dosed her when you have flasks to spare." "If there was corruption in her to purge, we'd purge it," the dragon said. "You can't heal absence. Consider yourself lucky she didn't burn with the heart tree, if you want to call it luck and not a pity." "A pity you didn't, if that's all the advice you have," Marek said. The dragon's eye glittered with what looked to me like a dozen cutting replies, but he compressed his lips and shut them in. Marek's teeth were moving against each other, and through his gripping hand I could feel strong, hard tension, a trembling, like a spooked horse, though he'd been as steady as a rock in that terrible glade with death and danger all around him. The dragon said, "There is no corruption left in her. For the rest, only time and healing will help. We'll take her back to the tower as soon as we've finished purging your men, and it's safe for them to go among other people. I'll see what else can be done. Until then, sit with her and talk of familiar things."
"Talk?"
Marek said. He shoved my arm out of his grip. More water slushed out over my feet as he stalked away. The dragon took the bucket from me, and I followed him back into the barn. "Can we do anything for her?" I asked.
"What is there to be done with a blank slate?" he said. "Give her some time, and she may write something new on it. As for bringing back whatever she was..." He shook his head.
Marek sat by the queen the rest of the day. I had glimpses of his hard, downturned face a few times when I came out of the barn. But at least he seemed to accept there wasn't going to be a sudden miraculous cure. That evening he got up and walked to Zatochik to speak to the village headman. The next day, when Tomasz and Oleg could finally walk as far as the well and back on their own, he gripped them hard by the shoulders and said, "We'll light a fire for the others tomorrow morning in the village square." Men came from Zatochik to bring us horses. They were wary of us, and I couldn't blame them. The dragon had sent word we would come out of the wood, and he'd told them where to keep us and what signs of corruption to look for. But even so, I wouldn't have been surprised if they'd come with torches instead to burn us all inside the barn. Of course, if the wood had taken possession of us, we'd have done worse things than sit in the barn quietly, exhausted, for a week. Marek himself helped Tomasz and Oleg up into their saddles before he lifted the queen up to her own, a steady brown mare, some 10 years old. She sat stiff and inflexible. He had to put her feet one by one into the stirrups. He paused, looking up at her from the ground. The reins hung slack in her manacled hands where he'd given them to her. "Mother," he tried again. She didn't look at him. After a moment, his jaw hardened. He took a rope and made a leading rein for her horse, hooked it to his own saddle, and led her on. We rode behind him to the square and found a tall bonfire assembled and waiting, full of seasoned wood, and all the village in their holiday best, standing on the far side. They held torches in their hands. I didn't know anyone from Zatoček well, but they came occasionally to our market days in spring. A handful of distantly familiar faces looked out at me from the crowd, like ghosts from another life through the faint gray haze of smoke, while I stood opposite them with the prince and wizards. Marek took a torch himself. He stood by the woodpile with his brand lifted into the air and named every man we had lost, one after another, and Janos at the last. He beckoned to Tomasz and Oleg, and together the three of them stepped forward and thrust their torches into the heaped wood. The smoke came smarting into my eyes and barely healed throat, and the heat was dreadful. The dragon watched the fire catch with a hard face and then turned away. I know he didn't think much of the prince honoring the men he'd led to their deaths, but it loosened something in me to hear all their names. The bonfire kept burning a long time. The villagers brought out food and beer, whatever they had, and pressed it on us. I crept away into a corner with Kasia and drank too many cups of beer, washing misery and smoke and the taste of the purging elixir out of my mouth, until finally we leaned against each other and wept softly. I had to hold on to her, because she didn't dare grip me tight. The drink made me lighter and more dull at the same time, my head aching and I snuffled into my sleeves. Across the square, Prince Marek was speaking to the village headman and a wide-eyed young carter. They were standing beside a handsome green wagon, fresh painted, with a team of four horses, their manes and tails clumsily braided in green ribbons also. The queen was already sitting in the wagon bed, cushioned on straw, with a wool cloak draped over her shoulders. The golden chains of the enchanted yoke caught the sunlight and glittered against her shift. I blinked a few times at the sun dazzle, and by the time I began to make sense of what I was looking at, the dragon was already striding across the square, demanding, "What are you doing?" I climbed to my feet and went to them. Prince Marek turned even as I came. "Arranging for passage to take the queen home," he said pleasantly. "Don't be absurd. She needs healing." "Which she can get in the capital as easily as here," Prince Marek said. "I don't choose to let you lock my mother up in your tower until it pleases you to let her out again, dragon. Don't imagine that I've forgotten how unwillingly you came with us. You seem ready to forget a great many other things," the dragon beat out, "such as your vows to raise the wood all the way to Rosia, if we succeeded." "I've forgotten nothing," Marek said. "I haven't the men to help you now. What better way to get you the men you need than by going back to the court to ask my father for them? The only thing you can do at court is parade around that hollow puppet and call yourself a hero," the dragon said. "Send for the men. We can't simply go now. Do you think the wood won't make answer for what we've done if we ride away and leave the valley defenseless?" Marek kept his fixed smile, but it trembled on his face, and his hand worked open and shut upon his sword hilt. The falcon smoothly inserted himself between them, laying a hand on Marek's arm, and said, "Your Highness, while Sarkin's tone is objectionable, he isn't mistaken." For a moment, I thought perhaps he understood now. Perhaps the falcon had felt enough of the malice of the wood for himself to realize the threat it made. I looked at the dragon with surprised hope, but his face was hardening even before the falcon turned to him with a graceful inclination of his head. "I think Sarkin will agree that despite his gifts, the willow exceeds him in the healing arts, and she will be able to aid the queen if anyone can. And it is his sworn duty to hold back the wood. He cannot leave the valley.
Very well, Prince Marik said at once, even though